KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
The Mission.
Excelsior.
Redwood City.
American Canyon.
San Francisco.
Vallejo.
I'm from Redwood City, so I guess that's in the peninsula.
Coming up, we meet a woman in the Central Valley who's gone from farm worker to restaurant owner.
O sea, el mole no lo puedes hacer rápido.
You can never make mole in a rush.
Then Ethiopia and Eritrea signed a peace deal. We'll meet some young men from both countries to ask what it means for them here in the Bay Area.
To see this outcome coming to happen, it was the magnitude that it had. Like, it was just crazy.
And from San Francisco StoryCorps, parenthood through the eyes of a modern family.
You were like, just so you know, I'm transgender. And I said, okay, are you gonna buy me a drink?
That's exactly what you said.
Stay tuned, Cross Currents is next. We've been airing pieces from our own Lisa Morehouse this week, stories that are part of her podcast, California Foodways. For today, we're going to take a little road trip down to the Central Valley. We're visiting a tiny restaurant owned by former farm workers, immigrant women from Oaxaca, Mexico. We'll let Lisa take it from here.
In the Central Valley town of Madera, teenager Yazid Alomari shows me around his family's business, Gateway Market.
We have some gloves over here. We have a huge variety of them. A lot of bandanas.
Hats, water coolers, buckets, and bags to hold picked fruit.
Right there we have shears to like cut vines, you know, pruning. The Falco number 2 is one of our best sellers right there. And those are used for the onions.
They're all supplies that local farm workers need. Some farm labor contractors hand out checks here, which workers cash right at the counter. Alomari speaks to his cousins and brother in Arabic and English, to customers in Spanish. He says customers come for more than checks and supplies. He's talking about the little restaurant tucked in a corner of the market.
Most of the people that come in here are from Oaxaca. So they get their food right there.
At this restaurant, which helps satisfy a longing for home for its customers and owners. Truck driver Carlos Santiago Gomez and a friend sit at a table covered in a bright woven tablecloth. He's taking his time with a traditional tamal filled with mole wrapped in a banana leaf.
Sabroso.
Sí.
Sí,
sabroso.
Bien sabroso.
He says it's delicious. Both men are originally from southern Mexico. Gomez from Guerrero, his friend from Oaxaca. Today, they drove all the way from the town of Selma, 45 minutes away.
Allá en Selma es diferente, pues allá no hay mucha comida así de esto.
He says there just isn't food like this where he lives. Traditional Oaxacan dishes with indigenous roots. Tamales, picaditas, pozole, mole. He can only get those here. Here, inside this market, is Colectivo Sabor a Mi Tierra, the tiny restaurant owned by Silvia Rojas and Rosa Hernandez. Rosa introduces herself in her indigenous language, Mixtec Alto. Then she grabs thick discs of masa right off the stove to make picaditas.
I'm seeing you shake your hand a little.
She pinches the hot dough to form spirals. She says it's a form that goes on forever and doesn't have an end. And she likes how that looks. Then Rosa spoons sauce and cheese over that form. She says even if it's covered, she wants it to be beautiful. When Rosa first moved to Madera nearly 30 years ago to work in the fields, she struggled to find the ingredients she grew up cooking with in the mountains of Oaxaca. Today, there's such a large Oaxacan population in Madera that those ingredients are pretty easy to find at the local swap meet. Chilies from the coast, herbs like epazote and hierba santa.
La hierba santa se usa para el pozole.
Rosa used to have to wait for someone to visit family in Oaxaca and bring Yerba Santa back in a suitcase. She says the sweet but bitter flavor makes her pozole taste Oaxacan. At another stall, Rosa sees chirimoya fruit, which grew so plentifully in her grandmother's backyard, they'd sometimes go bad. With these chirimoya at $10 a pound, Rosa says she'll just hold on to her memories of the fruit. This swap meet is kind of all about memories and community. She says people come here to buy familiar food, sure, but also to stroll around, kind of like they're in a plaza in Mexico. Growing up, Rosa says, if someone threw a big party, the whole community took the day off, making tortillas, grinding and toasting chilies, collecting the best wood for the stoves so the mole would come out perfectly. Rosa's usually calm, but she gets almost giddy when she sees this food memory come to life. A vendor selling all kinds of bread, imported from Oaxaca this week. There's pan dulce, including a Mixtec specialty, little empanadas filled with sweet squash called chilacayote. And we leave with a whole bag. Back at the restaurant, Rosa Hernandez's business partner, Silvia Rojas, makes tortillas by hand, 70 every day. Rosa prepares ingredients for the spicy mole specific to her hometown, starting with garlic, which she'll roast along with at least three types of chilies in a dry pan on the stovetop for a long time.
O sea, el mole no lo puedes hacer rápido.
She says mole can't be rushed.
Necesita mucho tiempo y mucha paciencia. Mucho amor a lo que vas a hacer, porque si no...
Without patience and love, she says, the mole isn't going to taste good. Oregano, cinnamon, sesame seeds, and cloves help form a paste to which she'll add blended tomatillos. Everything gets mixed in a pot with broth. So how did Rosa go from farm worker to restaurant co-owner? In the year 2000, she joined a leadership development program, the Pan Valley Institute, made up of immigrant women of Hmong, indigenous Mexican, and Central American roots. She remembers at one of those meetings, everybody brought important objects to share. Hers was a photo of her mother and father. All the women circled up and spoke about their objects. And Rosa says, for the first time, she talked about her family, something she'd guarded close in her heart because she hadn't wanted a painful reminder of home. She says she realized something that day.
Lo que nos unía era la añoranza. La tristeza.
That what united all the women in the room was having to leave something so important behind to come here. In that moment, she knew they were not from different places, but were all one woman with the same broken heart.
Éramos una sola mujer con el mismo corazón quebrado, muy quebrado.
That was a turning point for Rosa. She'd always brought Oaxacan food to these meetings. She says being part of that group gave her a clear sense of her cultural values and the confidence to start this restaurant. She and her business partner met with potential investors and the owner of the market where the restaurant is now. Rosa always brought her homemade tamales and jars of mole to sell them on the idea of the business. She says after years of doing farm work and cleaning houses, she realized that the food her mother taught her to make back in Oaxaca could actually earn her a living. She says she learned to see the cultural value in her food. Those picaditas she grew up eating for breakfast in Oaxaca, now, she says, it's a privilege to make them for her people here, in one of the only places you can find this food in the Central Valley. In Madera, I'm Lisa Morehouse for Cross Currents.
That story's part of Lisa's podcast, California Foodways. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. It was done in collaboration with the publication Civil Eats. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Earlier this month, the East African countries of Ethiopia and Eritrea signed a peace deal after decades of severed relations. The two nations fought a war in the 90s, after which all connection was cut off. No diplomatic ties, no trade, no transport, not even phone lines, despite a shared heritage and decades of intermarriage and close cultural ties. That's the sound of people celebrating aboard the first flight from Ethiopia to Eritrea in 20 years. The Bay Area has an estimated 12,000 Eritrean and slightly more Ethiopian residents, with large communities in cities like Oakland and San Jose. Many came as refugees decades ago, and there's a generation that grew up here or came as children. With their parents' generation on opposite sides of the divide, how do they relate to each other growing up together in the Bay Area, and how do they feel now? Rabael Gizachu is External Affairs Director for the Horn of Africa Student Association at UC Berkeley. He's Ethiopian. He brought with him his two Eritrean friends, Damon Tekle and Shishai Sabatu, and we all sat down in our studios for a chat about family trauma and healing.
The main reason I ended up in Eritrea was because me and my family were actually deported. We were kicked out of Ethiopia when I was 4 years old with my other three siblings and my mom. I remember, this was very vivid in my eyes actually, that Meles, which is the prior prime minister for Ethiopia.
Zenawi.
Yeah, Meles Zenawi, formally announcing on TV that all Eritreans are not welcome. And that, you know, led on to Eritreans being deported with trucks and vans and everything. I remember one night in 1998, they came in and just took my dad and deported him without us. And then a year after that is when me, my mom, and my other siblings followed. After I ended up in Eritrea as a four-year-old, I grew up there till I was like 16, 17, and then I had to migrate again to the United States.
And Damon, what about you? What's your family's story?
So my dad was a fighter, a soldier. He was in the war for about 8 years. And in the middle of it, he walked to Sudan or left Sudan. It's about like a 12-hour walk or, you know, and it was him and like a group of people. And he was one of the only people that made it through. There were people that died on their way there. And he stayed in about Sudan for a year. He first came to New York, was working there for a little bit. Then he came to California.
And what about you, Robel?
So my dad, he was a student. It was a communist regime in Ethiopia, 1970s. And it's just a lot of bloodshed, pretty much. And it was not much economic and political movement, I'd say, within the country. And so for that reason, my father and his friends decided not to stay at the school they were at, because they knew they'd eventually have to go. And so they ended up migrating around Europe, and then eventually got asylum in America.
So a lot of us come from countries where a lot is going on, right? And our parents and our grandparents had to deal with conflict, with struggle. So when you come here, you know, and then you start to build community, right? As a child here or as a teenager here, what were you hearing from your parents? What kind of stories were being told that maybe formed your ideas about, if you're Eritrean, about Ethiopians, or about, if you're Ethiopian, about Eritreans? Or was that not something they talked about in your house?
As an Ethiopian, what I noticed, because I probably met a lot of Eritreans prior to high school, but when I started high school, is when I like, really met and like got to understand what Eritrea was and their war for liberation, all of that. But prior to that, other Ethiopians and I, we're not really taught about Eritrea. And I remember when I first met my first Eritrean friend, his name's Abdul, he told me he was Eritrean, and I had no idea what that meant. I was like, what is Eritrea? I was like, you look like me. And I was like, I don't know what that is. It's crazy because it's literally right there. And there's so much war that happened between the two countries and so much history that it's sort of wild. I was never taught about Eritrea, I'd say. Mm-hmm. But yeah, definitely, it was new to me when I started in high school. And so, yeah.
So you met your first Eritreans in the U.S.
In the U.S., yeah. Mm-hmm. And from there on, it was a great experience. Like, a majority of my friend group is Eritrean. Especially, I went to Berkeley High School. We have a lot of Ethiopians and Eritreans there. And it was a great dialogue going on between the both of us. I mean, it would get heated sometimes about ideas that we've had for the two countries and things like that. But we had an Eritrean-Ethiopian student union together. You find that a lot throughout college campuses, throughout just the diaspora in general, not just America, but usually like any country you go to, most college campuses do have one. We were just privileged with our high school having so many that we were able to have one in high school. So yeah, so that's when I kind of started understanding and like making Eritrean friends and understanding what it meant for them to be Eritrean.
What about you, Damon? As a growing up Eritrean, what did you have Ethiopian friends?
So growing up, living in San Francisco, I grew up around a lot of Eritreans. There were like very few Ethiopians, mm-hmm. but I did have an Ethiopian friend, and it felt normal. It almost felt like he was one of us, you know? Mm-hmm. And growing up, my parents, when it came to Ethiopians, they kind of just, my dad really instilled in my brain that, like, you know, it was almost his duty to let me know how we came up and what happened. So I think, and whenever it came to like Ethiopian people, they're always, you know, positive about it, but they just let me know, you know what I'm saying? Like, this is what happened, this is how it is, and this is why we are.
Mm-hmm. So, and yeah. And Shishai, what about you?
I mean, for me, it's—
Because you came here.
Yeah.
17 is pretty old.
Very recent, yeah.
Like, you know things on exactly. your own. It's not your parents that
exactly.
had to tell you.
Yeah. And it's as you said right now, all the ideas and the thoughts that I've had is not based on my parents or what they taught me, kind of thing. I kind of had to observe and learn as I grew up, because I have both of those backgrounds, where I was born in Ethiopia, even though my family's from Eritrea. When it comes to the idea of how we perceive Ethiopians is, for the Eritreans, it's more so we have to be careful. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to be cautious, because we went at war for many years. And a lot of times, one thing that gets undermined with Ethiopians, but not Eritreans, is people usually forget in Ethiopia how much this costed us to be independent in Eritrea, and how much people that we lost. Mm-hmm. It's to the extent where that each household actually lost someone, like a person.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that being in a different place, like the U.S. or like the Bay Area even, can provide for like healing in a certain way? Like, you guys, all of you are friends. Ethiopian has Eritrean friends. The Eritrean has Ethiopian friends. You know your history very well. Mm-hmm. So do you feel that it's something about we're all migrants, or like we're all migrants from a similar area back home? Mm-hmm. What is it that brings you together?
Of course, the similarity brings us together, not just the immigrant factor, but also the food that we eat. There's a lot of similarities in that. One of the main textures of our food is there's something called injera, and that's one of the main dishes in both Eritrean and Ethiopia.
I think the audience will know.
Yeah, so there is some similar languages as far as like Tigrinya. It's kind of spoken in both, even though it's a different dialect in Ethiopia than mm-hmm. Eritrea. And a lot of times only Eritreans can notice that difference, and not all Ethiopians can notice that difference.
Are there common tribes?
There are similar tribes. So, mm-hmm. so the northern part of Ethiopia, the Tigray region, and also the Tigrinya of Eritrea are kind of similar. There's differences, but there are similar languages and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that parents' generation that's just like struggling with this idea? Like, are you guys having to like have conversations with your parents? And what are those like?
For Ethiopia specifically, I'd say it's difficult for them. You know, it's difficult to let go of everything that brought them here. You know, all this war that they had with their neighbors and things like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would say when it comes to that, I feel like yes, it is very difficult to have that conversation just because it brings back a lot of memories of friends that have passed away and whatnot.
Do you see your relationships
becoming better?
Changing in any way because of what happened?
I feel like more and more Ethiopians and Eritreans are growing up to be more open-minded to learning more history and understanding history, and not just celebrating things based on pride. You know, a lot of times you see on both sides, it's just we celebrate names of different rulers and leaders, forgetting what has been done to our people at the same time. But now it's seeing the progression of people in the right direction gives me hope that there's something better coming in the future. So, yeah, it's going to be better.
That was Rabael Gizachu, Damon Tekle, and Shishai Sabatu. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Now it's time for your stories. This is San Francisco StoryCorps. Just like other parents, Bethany Snyder and Christian Mall experience the joys and challenges of raising a strong-willed six-year-old. But this family is a little different because Christian is trans. Bethany and Christian sat down at the StoryCorps booth in San Francisco to talk about how they became a family and why it's important to tell their story.
Hi, my name is Bethany Snyder, and I am talking with my partner, Chris.
And my name is Christian Mall.
I was at a gay bar with some friends, and I saw Chris walk in with some friends, and I thought, that's someone I want to get to know. But I remember, like, right away, you were like, just so you know, I'm transgender. And I said, okay, are you going to buy me a drink?
That's exactly what you said. When I first kind of was starting to figure out my gender identity, I wasn't quite sure how I would maybe become a parent or if I would have a partner who would want to parent a child with me.
I knew, like, when I met you and we started talking, that I wanted to have a family with you.
We decided to wait until we had gotten married to start down that process. And Bethany basically let me, like, pick out the sperm donor. So
when it let you, I said, I'm going to do the rest of the work.
Right.
When she came out, I remember the first thing I thought was, oh my gosh, she has my eyebrows.
She
I could
does.
Just see, all I saw was eyebrows.
At birth, yeah, you could tell. So I'm a trans guy. I am not biologically related to Evelyn. And I think for some people, they're like, well, you know, does it feel like something's missing? And no, like nothing's missing. That matters 0% to me. But I can't imagine feeling any more connected to a human than I do to her.
In some ways, I feel like being a parent erases our LGBT identity out in the world. But in other ways, it's even more important now than ever for our daughter to understand, like, who we are as a family and who both of us are.
And she already knows, like, okay, there's this sperm donor person that helped biologically make her. Like, that's just part of her story. One of the things that I'm worried about is, as she gets older, is she going to start to feel that shame? Because I don't want her to. And it's like, I can't protect her from that, you know?
And I just hope she stays feisty.
That's one of the many qualities she's gotten from you, I think. Like last week when she decided to tell basically the whole Daisy Girl Scout troop that I'm transgender in the middle of the pumpkin patch field trip.
Yeah.
Like that. Yeah, I know. It is scary. I mean, in those moments, sometimes I freeze, like, oh my gosh, what am I supposed to do right now? Yeah, I mean, I think that's great that she's pushing me and us kind of outside of our comfort zone, because we know the way that we make policy change is to tell our stories.
The kindergarten teacher rethought about how she thought about gender, and the principal and the school psychologist, I'm thinking, like, this little six-year-old is impacting these four adults, and she doesn't even, like, just by being her, like, she doesn't even know it.
If now there are, you know, a dozen stay-at-home moms from Roseville, California, that know that they know someone who's transgender. Like, if that someday is going to impact the way that they vote on a ballot initiative, you know, who they vote for, it's worth me being uncomfortable at a pumpkin patch.
There aren't a lot of examples of trans dads in the world. Chris is the most amazing father.
Aw, thanks, honey.
The rest of today's Cross Currents team includes Muna Danish, Janae Darden, Nina Gentler-Debs, Nicholas Harder, Angela Johnston, Kristen McCandless, Truk Nguyen, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Eli Wirtschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. The content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is Jen Chien, and our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Hilux from Oakland. The first ever performance is taking place at an album release party. That's Friday night at Slate Bar in San Francisco. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.